Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Daniel Sherman, author of French Primitivism and the Ends of Empire, 1945 to 1975. The book was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2011. Hi there, Dan.
Hi, Roxane.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I wonder if you could get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in working on France.
Well, I'm a historian, currently teaching in the art history program at UNC Chapel Hill. And like I think many authors you've talked to, in this series, I can trace my interest in France to two things, an early childhood or childhood experiences of the country, and a great college teacher. My mother is an art historian, a medievalist, and I was four when she went with the whole family to France to do research on her dissertation on images of a 14th century French king. So I had the great privilege of visiting France several times as a child, as a teenager, and to make friends there whom I've kept for decades. But so in fact, the family whose pension we stayed in when I was four, we're still in touch with. It was a large family, which now extends to three generations, I think. And these are people I still see when I'm in France. And I've always felt a little as though I have a French family. But when I started college, I thought that I was going to become a historian of Britain, and I had the great good fortune in my second year of college of taking a really fascinating, powerful, dense course on political ideas and society, modern France. And I took that course, and I was hooked. The instructor is somebody who is well known to historians of France, but also in other domains, because he's a well-known scholar of international relations, Stanley Hoffman. He agreed to direct my senior thesis, my undergraduate senior thesis, for which I got a research grant between my junior and senior years of college. And although the research didn't, in retrospect, the first research project is always a little dicey. I was 20. I was working on the interwar period. And at that point in France, archivally speaking, it was really too soon. So, the thesis, it was a perfectly respectable undergraduate thesis, but I did catch the archival bug, the research bug. And I remember sitting on the plane in Paris on the way back to the States for my senior year, thinking, this is how I want to come back to France. I don't want to come back as a tourist. I want to, this was really, with all of its frustrations and annoyances and unexpected, not always pleasant surprises in the archives. This is what I want to do. This is the kind of connection to France that I want to have. And I feel extraordinarily lucky that I have been able to maintain that kind of connection to France in the years since.
Dan, you've written and edited a number of books dealing with art and aesthetics, museums, memory and commemoration in France. And I'm wondering how you think about this project on French primitivism, and we'll get into what that means and the details of the book in a few moments. But I'm just wondering about the relationship of this work to your broader body of work.
Well, I'm not sure I'm the best person to talk about that, because I think that, you know, I've had the experience of reading several books by other scholars and noticing strands in them that seem consistent, that seem to indicate some kind of persistent interest. And when I've had the opportunity to mention it to those scholars, there's one I can think of in particular, they confessed total, I mean, they didn't deny it, but these were things that they hadn't noticed. I guess a simpler way of putting this is that I see every project that I undertake as distinct, and I start with different problematics and different questions and different theoretical frameworks, not necessarily explicitly because it really depends on what I've been reading, what I've been thinking about, what I've been talking to other scholars about. So my second book, which came out in 1999 on war memorials in commemoration of the First World War in France, I'd been thinking a lot about gender. And that's really an important orienting framework for that book. When I started working on this project, I'd been thinking a lot about and reading a lot about colonialism. So that set the framework for this book. That said, you're certainly right that there are, I consider myself a cultural historian, and I think that you can do cultural history with almost any materials. I think, you know, you can do a cultural history of, I don't know, rural electrification. Mm-hmm. But it's also true that my materials have always been somewhere in the visual sphere, in the realm of visual culture, and also, as often as not, somewhere close to the what we think of as high culture, as art. And that, I think, has to do with my background and my interests, and also, frankly, the fact that, you know, once you've published something in one area, people keep asking you to publish, you know, to people expect you, always expect me to have things to say about museums and memorials. And I usually do, but it's certainly a domain in which I feel at home.
So in the book's introduction, Dan, you offer readers a kind of overview of primitivism and its treatment as an object of study by previous scholars. So perhaps we could start with this. I mean, I'm not going to ask you to give me a definition of primitivism, because I think that's part of the point of the book, is to interrogate that. But could you say a little bit about the field of definitions as it existed as you began this work, leading up to your discussion of French primitivism after 1945? Is there a way that we could start with something like, what is primitivism? What are some of the key moments and issues in its history in France and maybe even beyond?
Well, the thing about primitivism is that even more than most cognate terms, it's very slippery. And, you know, the related term with which most people, I think, are familiar is Orientalism. I talk a little bit about mm-hmm. that in the introduction, but I think it's pretty firmly ingrained in people's minds, certainly among scholars across the humanities and social sciences, that Orientalism describes the way that people from the West, people who are not from what they define or understand as the Orient, think about others, think about people they consider Orientals. And of course, in the first instance, the privileged objects are from the Middle East and the Levant, not from the Far East, from East Asia. But with primitivism, there's a long, and so we don't think of Orientalism as a some kind of complex, you know, I don't want to say disease, but something that affects Oriental people. Mm-hmm. Whereas with primitivism, there was long a tendency to think of primitivism as something characteristic of people we understood as primitive. Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm at pains in the book to make clear, and just to parenthetically, there's historians have talked about the way primitivism is occasionally used as a clinical term. I mean, not recently, but as recently as, say, the 1950s, mm-hmm. In colonial medicine, as applied to people in, say, North Africa. So it was considered a kind of psychological malady that could be diagnosed, if not treated. But what I'm interested in is primitivism as a set of ideas that Western people, that people who consider themselves civilized, use to understand other kinds of people in other places, typically places explored and colonized by Europeans and other Westerners. It's a, globally speaking, it's a tendency to see in the uncivilized, and of course, this is a podcast, I'm making little scare quote motions with my fingers at all of these terms, but it's necessary to use them in order to critique them. Ways that the civilized think about people in places they view as uncivilized, as untouched by civilization. And the peculiar thing about primitivism, and really my starting point, is that it tends to be a romanticizing set of ideas that takes off from, say, from hierarchical thinking about races, certainly, but that tends to turn civilization against itself. So a typical primitivist idea is that those who have not been affected or contaminated by modernity, by all of the things that the West takes pride in, have something to teach those of us who have been affected by modernity, that there's something more authentic, more unspoiled about their lives, that they are in closer touch with nature and with their sort of inner selves, and that if we can, we modern or modernized Westerners can come into contact with that in some way, it will be beneficial to us. Mm-hmm. The classic manifestation of this has been in the arts, in the visual arts, not just in France, although France is a certainly one of its privileged starting points. So when Paul Gauguin, say, in the 1890s, goes to French Polynesia in search of inspiration, in search of a simpler way of life, in search of something pure and raw, and then incorporates it, what he finds or what he thinks he finds, into his art. When 10 years later, Picasso does the same thing with African masks, when the German Expressionists do that, that is the form of primitivism that is best known in cultural history and is certainly very familiar in art history. But I wanted to take that concept and see if it could be applied more broadly, not just to the production of high art, but to society at large.
It's one of the really fascinating things about the book that you do, in fact, engage with high art, but then extend that out to think about other domains. And you offer the book down as an intervention in at least two major areas of discussion and debate when it comes to the study of France. So the first is the interweaving of French and imperial history, as you say. And then the second is the history of this period, the Trente Glorieuses, the 30 glorious years from 1945 to 1975. So I'm wondering if you could say something about how the book, in sort of broad terms, contributes to these two areas of scholarly focus and interest.
Well, I think that the two are very much connected, and because the way that I wanted to inflect the history of the Trente Glorieuses was by introducing both unease about the modernization that's incarnated in the phrase the 30 glorious years, which was invented, by the way, by an economist. Mm-hmm. So it's really about boom. It's really about the transformation of France into a modern economic power. I also wanted to bring into it. So the idea of the 30 glorious years is that despite all of the upheaval, despite the loss of empire, despite the catastrophe of the Algerian War and the regime change that it brings about in the metropole, the creation of the Fifth Republic, and then enhanced, intensified presidentialization in 1962, despite all of that, what one wants to retain, as the French would say, from this period is the continuities, the economic expansion, the demographic expansion, state planning that promotes expansion, that begins in the Fourth Republic and continues into the technocratic Fifth Republic. Things that continue until the oil shock of the mid-70s shakes up the entire global economy. And what I was trying to do, what a lot of historians have been trying to do, is to say, well, no, you can't. You don't have to tell the story of the Fourth Republic and the first 15 years of the Fifth Republic either as one of constant or continual political crisis and renewal, or as one of steady economic expansion, that by paying attention to the importance of all kinds of relations with overseas France and what had been overseas France, and then it's what became the former empire, its peoples, its cultures, that one can tell a more complex and more subtle story of France as a country, as a society, entangled in larger colonial and post-colonial relations.
You talked about the fact that primitivism is a sort of broad conceptual term and movement in art beyond France, but the book is focused on French primitivism. So what makes French primitivism French?
Well, I think that the French have a somewhat greater set of illusions, to put it baldly, about their relationship to other parts of the world and their ability to get into the mindset, get inside the heads of people who had been their colonial subjects. I imagine that there are historians of the British Empire out there who would contradict me on this, and I don't pretend to be an expert on any other empire. But I think that French primitivism is fed by this sense of French of French universalism, of France as incorporating certain universal values, including a form of humanism that, over and above the contradictions and the paradoxes and the cruelties and injustices of any colonial system, they believe somehow redeems the failures and the crises of the last years of their imperial rule or of their large scale empire. And let's not forget that that there is still an overseas France, which territories in the Antilles, in the Pacific, in the Indian Ocean, that actually continue to send elected representatives to the French Parliament. Mm-hmm. So I think that that sense that somehow, to paraphrase General de Gaulle's famous speech in Algiers in June of 1958, that the French have understood their colonial subjects, which persists even after their colonial subjects have made clear that they do not wish to be understood any further within the framework of colonialism, is a pretty powerful drive for French primitivism.
So in the second chapter of the book, Dan, you talk about the Musée des Arts et Traditions Populaires that was originally created in 1937, and you give us a kind of overview of the history of the museum. And specifically in the period that the book focuses on, you look at the history of the museum in relationship to this history of French ethnology and a kind of back and forth between colonial and metropolitan contexts and missions. And I wonder if you could just sort of give us a sense of the significance of that museum and its development in this period and this idea of the colonial inheritance of French ethnology and ethnography.
Yeah, well, what fascinated me about the ATP, as it's known, for Art et Tradition Populaire, is that the methods that it used for gathering materials, for collecting objects, but also for its larger scholarly and scientific mission, which was to record the traditional or the customs of and practices of traditional French society before they rural French society. It's important to specify that before they disappeared, that those methods were borrowed very directly from the methods being worked out at the same time in the French colonies. And there is a direct connection between the founding director of this museum, the Musée des Arts et Traditions Populaires, a man called Georges-Henri Rivière, and the people who were building French ethnology as a discipline, what we would call cultural anthropology. And for a very long time, not just in France, but throughout the developed West, anthropology was understood to be a field that studied traditional societies, sometimes the word primitive was thrown in, whether it was in the early days of anthropology in the United States, American Indians in the Southwest, or whether it was tribes, Amazonian tribes, or African peoples, the more remote, the less contaminated by Western culture, the better. But what interested me is that the methods of field work, the kinds of recording, the instructions for how to approach people and how to get them to confide in you and, you know, how to eventually get them to give you stuff for your museum, were basically taken pretty much wholesale from the kinds of guides and manuals that were used for, you know, dealing with the peoples I just mentioned in Africa, in Oceania, in South America, and applied to people in quote unquote remote areas of France, the Massif Central, the Auvergne, farthest reaches of Brittany, the mountainous regions of the Southwest, and so on. So this is a kind of direct application of primitivism to people who are the fellow citizens of the ethnographers carrying out the investigation. And I wanted to explore that kind of internal othering, the particular course it takes in the 50s and 60s, which is one of, I would say, increasingly, can we think of nostalgia as mingled with desperation? because it's, you know, what they're looking for, these traditional rural folkways are, you know, they're always disappearing. They're always gone. And they're always just kind of, you know, about to fade out of view. And the idea that we need kind of scientific techniques, we need tape recorders, we need projection equipment. I mean, we need recording equipment. We need lots and lots of ethnographers with notebooks making lists, you know, to preserve what is regarded as kind of the core of French civilization. It's one of the paradoxes at the heart of primitivism that I found particularly rewarding to explore.
Well, and if this first chapter, focuses in some ways on these sort of concepts and practices of a kind of domestic ethnographic work, the third chapter in the book really focuses on this placement of artifacts, you know, once you have the stuff. But you talk about the placement of artifacts in, well, at least one perhaps less expected context, looking at the Musée des Arts Africains et Océaniens, but also looking at home decorating magazine spreads, and kind of putting those things together as places where artifacts are relocated and presented. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about how that works.
Well, I was, in this chapter, I was really guided by Joan Scott's work on fantasy. Mm-hmm. Her initial work on fantasy, the article Fantasy Echo, because this was done before the recent book on fantasy as a historiographical concept. But fantasy as a construct that resolves conflict and that presents a kind of a picture of things in conflict that from which the conflict is removed and there's a kind of seamless whole. And the decorating magazines, these are art magazines for the most part with decorating features in them, mm-hmm. which is interesting in itself. I mean, I when I started going through these magazines, I was not looking for the pieces on decorating. They just kind of popped out, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I realized that, and I was particularly, what particularly drew me in was a piece by a then quite young French designer, called André Putman, who died a year or so ago, and whom I have a chance to interview a couple of times, in which the decorating style that she was proposing, which merged the, you know, very modern furniture by, say, Knoll, the Knoll firm, and artifacts from primitive or, let's just say, early cultures, early Christian, Coptic, Iberian, whatever. But she called this style association, you know, which is a kind of a red flag for French historians, because it's one of the key words of French colonial doctrine, right? So what interested me about this was the way these decorating, these images sort of seamlessly associated the culture of the West, of the modern West, and culture then, and artifacts of what were then considered to be more primitive peoples. And that this was happening in, you know, at the height of the Algerian War, perhaps not the height of the last years of the Algerian War, 1960, 61, 62, when a lot of the violence was being brought home. So it seemed to me to involve a, you know, at the very least, enormous powers of concentration. And let's go, you know, or let's say also denial, to be thinking that you could reconcile, that, you know, you could associate these various styles in this seamless way in your living room. And it's, and there was a kind of instant gratification about it that, and you know, it was not just in this, in these features by André Putman in the magazine L'Œil, or I, which is a, you know, an art magazine that still exists, but the style then spread to other art magazines and to, you know, more middle brow magazines, like the French version of House and Garden, where it was, you know, it called the kind of the trend of the moment. And it seemed to me what was going on was it was providing the kind of instant gratification that was much more difficult to achieve in the kind of cumbersome structure of a museum, because this the museum that you mentioned and that I discuss in the second part of chapter three, the Museum of African and Oceanic Art, was created basically out of nothing in 1960 to occupy the space formerly, well, that was built to house a museum of French colonialism, basically, a French colonial museum. And it took, and really there was no model at the time for a museum of the, you know, what people thought of as primitive art. The kind of parallel American example was later, the Museum of Primitive Art in New York, which is was later folded into the Metropolitan Museum as the Michael C. Rockefeller wing, and the Belgian cognate, the museum, what is now called the Congo Museum in Tervoren outside of Brussels, was not exactly a model either, because the whole point of this museum was to, as the Minister of Culture, André Malraux, famously said in a speech in Niamey, forget colonialism. Get past colonialism. Well, it took a while to do that. I mean, the museum really didn't, and there was criticism of this in the press. They had to basically acquire a whole collection. They had to figure out how to install it artistically. You know, they had to attend to this, you know, not very old, but already by 1960. I mean, it was built for the 1931 Colonial Exposition, and already by the 60s, it was leaky and crumbling. And so it took over a decade for them to put together anything approaching a full collection. But what these two things have in common for me, the fashion magazines or the decorating features in the art magazines and the museum, is that they both use aesthetics as a way of masking politics. And I think from their own point of view, to go back to what I was saying earlier about about universalism and common humanity, to overcome, to transcend the legacy of political division on the basis of a kind of common aesthetic understanding.
Mm-hmm. There does seem to be, not just in this chapter, although certainly in a more intense way in this chapter, this kind of tension between these strategies and practices of collection and display, and, you know, how objects are acquired and then presented and represented, but then also this other story of concealment and masking that comes up again and again and with respect to the colonial empire. In the fourth chapter, Dan, you talk about a number of artists. You talk about Jean Dubuffet, who's perhaps better known than the other artist that you spend a lot of time on in the book, Gaston Chaissac, as these totemic artists that also engage with and become central in the ways that people think about primitivism in France in this period. And I'd just like to ask you to say a little bit more, especially about Chaissac. You know, who was he, and why is his work so significant in the arguments that you're making here in the book?
So Chaissac was a largely, but not entirely, and that's important, self-taught artist, born in 1910, who spent most of his mature career as a living in the wilds of the Vendée, where his wife was a schoolteacher. He came into the orbit of Jean Dubuffet in the late 40s, at the time that Dubuffet was elaborating his idea of what he called art brut, which we now know, or which we now translate by the fairly widespread term outsider art. And but it's worth pointing out that the first English language book on outsider art by Roger Cardinal was a book very much about Dubuffet's, or inspired by Dubuffet's efforts, which were not the first, but which were the first kind of organized efforts to collect and preserve work by self-taught artists as its own category, as a category challenging the norms and customs and hierarchies of the art world. And that book by Roger Cardinal, which came out in the early 70s, the term outsider art was one that he worked out in consultation with Dubuffet. So, you know, it's a term that, you know, is very widespread in the art world now and is quite familiar, but one can trace it back to this undertaking by Dubuffet. Now, Chaissac interested me from fairly early on. I mean, when I started the project, I thought I was just going to do a chapter on art brut as another form of kind of internal primitivism. Mm-hmm. But Chaissac interested me because very early in their relationship, which remained friendly until Chaissac's death at the early age of fairly early age of 54, mm-hmm. In 1964. But very fairly early in their relationship, Dubuffet basically decided that Chaissac knew too much, that he was not brute enough, that he was not really an outsider, because he was in contact with intellectuals like Jean Paulhan and Michel Ragon, because he showed his work at salons of that were open to, I mean, they were fairly generally open, but there were places where you saw established work. So he was, although Dubuffet remained interested in him and continued to acquire some of his work, he was put outside the category of the outsider. And yet, throughout his career, he tended to be treated as somehow primitive. And this is where the kind of confusion between the different possible senses of primitivism is most interesting or most acute. So what I ended up concluding about Chisok, on the basis of evidence that might be more convincing to art historians than to historians, but nobody's complained about this too much in the reviews. Chisok had really, was himself a primitivist. That he had absorbed in the visual and intellectual culture of his time, because he was very well read and very, very curious. Colonialism, primitivism as a structure of consciousness. So that when he painted, a sort of rough but always kind of amiable, smiling figures on stumps of wood and called them totems, it wasn't because, he was channeling ideas he had learned and read about the way so-called primitive peoples made art. And, in his extraordinarily abundant I'm sure it's cost me a couple of years of my vision, barely legible correspondence. There are references to, one of the iconic sort of sets of images of commodity racism, that is the Banania ads. Mm-hmm. He was doing what artists going back to Gauguin and Picasso and Klee and others had done. He was trying to approach some kind of purity of expression or creativity through ideas, often simplistic, that he had gathered about primitive societies, but he was treated by the critics as himself a primitive. Mm-hmm. So it was, not so much as a mature conscious artist doing these things out of choice, but as somebody who, and this is one of the critical texts that I talk about and analyze, who was working through his own compulsions, who could not help himself. Mm. And this was something that I found actually, when I first came across it, quite shocking. Even in people who, this was in a, well, I can't, the there were a number of texts like this, but certainly one in the first big retrospective of his work in 1972 at the Musée National d'Art Moderne, what's now at the Pompidou Center. This was before the Pompidou Center was finished, so it was still in the Palais de Tokyo. Mm-hmm. The idea that, he was making art like this because he was kind of psychologically distressed, and this was a way of working it out for him, so almost as though he didn't know what he was doing. And there were references references to the dark night and primordial dawns and all this kind of thing, which, you just have to read some of his texts to understand this is really quite a sophisticated, quite an intelligent man who admittedly cultivated as part of his production, I would say, a certain kind of rustic persona, mm-hmm. but from which he got good publicity. So this was really, and I remember the first time I gave a talk about this before a very, before an academic audience, a friend said to me, it was only really about halfway through your lecture that I realized you were making a distinction between primitive and primitivist. And I said, well, I'm glad you got it. glad it was halfway and not, you know, the end of the whole thing.
Well, and those contradictions are really apparent in your discussion of Shitak and how he's, you know, received by critics and by his peers, I guess, during this period. That mm-hmm. sort of idea that primitivism, that there's a double bind and that there are these contradictions and this tension that really runs throughout the book between these ideas of modernity and tradition also run throughout the last chapter before the epilogue, Trouble in Paradise, where you actually take us to French Polynesia and look at these questions of tourism and the myth of preservation. And I'm just wondering about the argument that you're making here, just quoting you here, in this special context of an enduring rather than terminal colonialism, the context of French Polynesia.
Well, that chapter came about in a funny way. I mean, I think that's one of the rewarding things about research, that it takes you in directions you don't normally expect. But when I was laying out this project, that was going to be a chapter about Club Med, which does kind of make a brief appearance, which is of which the advertising slogan for a long time, as you may remember, was an antidote to civilization. Mm. There was an article that Ellen Furlow published in French Historical Studies about Club Med. Scholars were certainly interested in it. I wasn't, the first to think that it was worth exploring further. And I did spend some time with their newsletter, Le Trident, mm-hmm. But found that it was virtually impossible to gain access to the corporate archives that I would have needed. And I was also not the first to encounter that roadblock. So I was trying to find more information about the early Club Med village in Tahiti, in French Polynesia. And, this is in the 50s, before the dawn of jet travel. So, Club Med was started as a way of offering sort of authentic primal pleasures, shall we say, to the European middle class at an affordable price. It would be a week on in the Canary Islands, or a week on, again in the 50s on one of the less traveled parts of the Côte d'Azur, that kind of thing, or weeks, in the ski resort, not a resort, in the winter. And so but they had this village in Tahiti. And so normally, it was like a 2-week package. Whereas for the village in Tahiti, it was 3 months, because it took a month to get there by boat. And you spent a month there, and then it took another month to get back. And of course, most of it was mostly kind of symbolic. Very few people could afford to take advantage of this, but it was written up a lot in Le Trident and celebrated as kind of the wellspring of the inspiration for the Club Med. So I was looking in the archives of the overseas ministry for material on tourist development, hoping that I would find more information about this village in Tahiti. And I didn't find much, but I found copious information about tourism as a way of developing French Polynesia while also preserving its authentic, that is to say, primitive culture. Mm-hmm. And in the 50s, in the post-war, there was a very serious autonomous movement, and a leader who had a quite large following throughout Polynesia, throughout the various archipelagos, who the new Gaullist regime, regarded as a serious threat. Mm-hmm. And so they were looking for ways to provide a better livelihood for the Polynesians, who were without kind of completely spoiling what the French, going back to Gauguin, who it must be noted, was actually disappointed by the capital of the territory, Papeete, what they had regarded as its kind of fundamental primitive character. So there were a lot of schemes for tourist development, and they quickly came up against what became the primary strategic interest of Polynesia after the French withdrawal from retreat from Algeria, which was using one of the more remote archipelagos, of course it's all relative, as a testing ground for nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And so what the French had envisioned as a kind of gradual modernization that would be spurred by tourist development, by, you know, carefully managed infrastructure and development, hotel building, various other kinds of employment opportunities in the larger tourist sector, actually became in the mid-60s a very rapid, almost brutal modernization as the French built on Tahiti itself, which is considerable distance from the actual testing grounds. But on Tahiti, they built the sort of the command center, the base, mm-hmm. for the support staff, both for the military and for the French Atomic Energy Commission that was supervising the tests. And this didn't stop them from wanting to, you know, develop tourism, especially after the first moratorium on testing in the late 70s. But it becomes this contradiction, mm-hmm. paradox within the whole enterprise and the governance of Polynesia. And I guess what struck me and what I tried to explore is how you can at the same time be using this territory and its people in this very brutal way, mm-hmm. And at the same time believe that it's possible to preserve something primitive in it.
And to promote that as a tourist destination.
And to promote that as a tourist destination, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, and throughout the five chapters of the book, you kind of pursue those contradictions and tensions in the notion of the primitive and primitivism. I was really struck, Dan, by the epilogue. I mean, in the introduction to the book, you talk about, one of the kind of reasons to write the book, that there's this persistent and unselfconscious, and I'm quoting here, persistent and unselfconscious primitivism in France that lasts into the 21st century, long after it has come under challenge elsewhere. And your epilogue begins with this question: why has primitivism remained a live force in French culture? And I wonder about that, as how you see the book as a contribution to on contemporary and ongoing issues in French culture. How you kind of answer that question: why is that the case that in France this remains such a live force? And how you address that in the epilogue, and how you see the book as a contribution to that conversation.
Well, I think that the primary instance of this, and it's one of the four little subsections of the epilogue, but probably the longest, is the Musée du Quai Branly, mm-hmm. The museum that takes over the collections of the African and Oceanic Art Museum, as well as the ethnographic collections of the Musée de l'Homme, the Museum of Man, in a new, very expansive and very expensive structure built just east of the Eiffel Tower that opened in 2006. Mm-hmm. And this very much incarnates a persistent strand in French diplomacy, but also in French self-understanding, in this case, central to Jacques Chirac's view of his legacy or the kind of legacy he wanted to promote, which is, you know, the idea of France as champion of the Third World of people who had been, and he famously, and there's this whole litany of, and I'm just looking in the book for some of the adjectives, people who had been scorned, despised, brutalized, and left out of the discourses of civilization. So, the idea that by promoting African, oceanic, Native American art as equal to saying that there is no hierarchy in culture, France is demonstrating its open-mindedness and its continued uniqueness in the community of nations, and certainly by implication in comparison to the U.S. The one word that Chirac did not use in his speech to describe these peoples brutalized, exterminated, humiliated, and scorned. That's just there's an ellipsis in there. But this is at the dedication, the opening of the museum in 2006. But the one word he doesn't use is colonized. Mm-hmm. So again, there's, and I think that in the, this kind of universalism then becomes a way of not having to say you're sorry for colonialism. And this is just a year and a half or so after the notorious and fortunately short-lived law that requiring the French public school curriculum to teach the positive effects of French colonialism. But it's also just a few months after the riots in the suburbs of Paris and other major cities that reflect the ongoing tensions between between France as a European country and France as a multicultural society with a significant immigrant population. So universalism becomes a way of not having to say you're sorry for any of this. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are traces of it. There certainly, I certainly wouldn't claim that France is the only place where aesthetics is put to this particular purpose. But I do think that the acknowledged French prowess in the arts, in culture as a place where culture is taken seriously and where whatever their other failings, they've always been good at cultural things. I think that it makes this kind of discourse easier both to formulate and to propagate.
Well, Dan, I've taken up a lot of your time, and I have one final question that I'd like to ask you, which is, what are you working on now?
Well, that's a good question. And I guess I'm in the early stages of a project on archaeology, museums, and the concept of cultural property in France and its empire from the late 19th century to the present. So it both reflects some of the things I've been interested in over the whole course of my career and takes me in new directions as well. So, just so I don't get bored.
Well, it sounds like an exciting project, and I hope I'll have a chance to check in with you about it and perhaps interview about it.
That would be lovely.
Soon. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today, Dan, and for writing the book.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to New Books in French Studies. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll join us again next time.